You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
That's right. Drink your juice a little at a time. Doesn't it taste good?
Welcome to episode 188 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by Movie Rob from the Movie Rob Minute to discuss a 1958 film that features a romance with a 21-year age gap, starring Clark Gable, Doris Day, Gig Young, and Mamie Van Doren, directed by George Seton. It's Teacher's Pet. But first...
You know, so many people are asking how the Millers manage to have so much fun as a family.
What's the answer? Is it money? Or is it...
The Forgotten Filmcast.
Monsters do have their place. In the zoo, in your nightmares, in the deep, in your favorite horror movies. But not in your living room, on your TV. Don't let pay TV be the monster in your living room. Pay TV and cable TV companies are seeking the right to charge you for the very programs you now get free. If you want to stop pay TV and save free television, sign the petition in the lobby of this theater. Let your lawmakers know how you feel in the fight against pay TV and cable TV.
Today we're interviewing a stomach.
Hello there.
What is life like as a stomach?
Oh, boy, it was humdrum. I mean, until what's-his-name discovered Tony's Pizza.
Tony's Pizza?
Yeah, I was suffering from the pizza cravings until Tony's came along. Crispy crust and zesty sauces. Wow!
And so now... What's that?
Another pizza craving. Just thinking about Tony sets it off.
Oh, where are you going?
He's going to get a Tony's Pizza. And I follow him anywhere.
Does your stomach send you pizza craving signals? Oh, wow. Tony's, the pizza craver's pizza. Available at the concession stand.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time, soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
Don't you listen to me. I happen to know
Don't you
what
think I should be consulted?
What happened to my right?
Look, I wrote it. I happen to know
I
what the good...
I am going to insist that I'm going to...
Oh, hi. My name is Carl Reiner.
You know who's doing all that screaming in there? Doris Day, James Garner, Arlene Francis, the stars of the thrill of it all, and the producers, and the heads of the studio, all arguing which scene to show you for the preview. They've all got their favorite scenes. Doris Day finally prevailed upon them to let me decide. I'm the author. They're all my favorite scenes. Hey, you know what we're going to do? We're going to do something that's never been done before in a preview. We're going to show you the whole movie. Don't tell Doris. Of course, we only have 2 minutes, so we'll have to move it along. Eddie, roll the whole picture.
The whole picture?
The whole picture. Roll it. Move it, Eddie. Eddie, slow down. Slow down. Here's the scene Doris was crazy about.
I helped a lady become pregnant.
What did you do?
It's all right. He's really a doctor. It's his business. Move it, Eddie. Oh, Jim Garner's favorite was the bit where Doris is the housewife, gets a chance to do a commercial on TV. Doris!
You pig! You're on!
Oh, hello. I'm a Beverly Boyer, and I'm a pig.
Pig?
Pig!
Pig?
Slow it, Eddie. Slow it down. No, that's not the one. Keep it going. No, Eddie, keep it going. That's not... Just keep rolling. Oh, this I gotta show you.
You're a sweet, wonderful woman. Gloria.
Gloria! Oh!
Keep going. Arlene Francis picked this one. She loves romance.
Oh, Gerald! Oh, honey, are you all right? Darling?
But there was one scene we all agreed you'd like. Eddie, slow down. And especially what happens when Jim goes down to put the car away.
I forgot to tell you we have a pool!
Eddie, we don't have time. Move it! Well, we did it. You saw the whole picture. A little too fast, perhaps, but this theater has been instructed to show you the thrill of it all at the proper speed when it runs here as its next attraction. Come back and see Doris Day and James Garner in regular speed and color.
And now, on with the show.
Excuse me, I was just wondering if I left a book here, but I guess not.
I'm glad you came back, Mr. Gallagher. Do you have a moment?
Certainly.
Well, I've just been reading your story again, and it's absolutely amazing to think you've had no experience.
Well, I sold papers as a kid, and, I play poker every week with a friend of mine, a reporter. That's all.
Well, it's just excellent. Oh, but there is one thing, Mr. Gallagher. In the future, use triple space. That's the way they do it on newspapers.
Oh, they do?
Oh, yes. Oh,
thanks, I'll remember.
And, of course, phrases like trigger-happy are a bit hackneyed. But we'll get rid of those cliches, won't we? Now, what business are you in?
Paper. Wallpaper.
Uh-huh. Wallpaper. And why are you taking this course? In other words, just what are you after?
Well, that's pretty hard to put into words. To tell you the truth, I didn't want to come here in the first place. My boss forced me to do it. You see, he's planning on getting out a weekly down at the plant. You know, Dolly Spring from shipping and Harry Harper from legal have decided to tie the knot. That sort of dribble.
Oh. Well, naturally, I was hoping that... You mean you're really not interested in...
Oh, no, I didn't say that. But I must admit, I was pretty teed off the first time I came here. My friend, the reporter, he said that you'd be a frustrated old biddy who'd read all the textbooks and never written a line. And taking a course from someone like that would be like betting on a three-legged horse, he said.
Then you must have agreed with that letter of Mr. Gannon's.
No. I wouldn't go as far as he, you know, but... You know, you were pretty rough on him. Awfully rough. And I don't think he meant...
Rough?
I should have been a lot rougher. Well, I've never heard...
Well, he's no bum, you know. Mm-hmm. He's pretty well thought of. My friend, the reporter, he says he's one of the best in the
But he still considers journalism a trade. It's not a trade, Mr. Gallagher. It's a profession. And the basic fundamentals can be taught the same as in medicine. But Mr. Gannon doesn't agree. Oh, no. He'd like to see surgeons operating at the age of 10 and learn by trial and error.
Now, wait a minute. I'm sure he thought you had a lot of fakers here, but I'll bet if he could talk to you for 5 minutes or heard you lecture, he'd know that you had real newspaper experience the same as I did.
Of course I've had experience, and so has every other instructor in this school.
Now, wait a minute. You don't have to sell me, you know, after last week.
Oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have gotten so angry. Forgive me. It's just that
All right, but, you know, there's one thing I can't quite figure.
What?
How could you give up a real newspaper job for teaching?
Well, that's a very good question, Mr. Gallagher. Maybe for the same reason that occasionally a musician wants to be a conductor. He wants to hear 100 people play music the way he hears it. If I can influence a few students who might someday become reporters and eventually editors, well, I think it's worth a try. You see, I have my own ideas about what newspapers should be. And I know they can be a great deal better than they are. Now, look at this. Blood and sex. Oh, journalism is so much more than blood and sex.
You like my story about that murder. That's blood, isn't it?
Well, now, wait a minute. I didn't say that I disapprove of blood. It's just that...
How do you feel about sex?
Well, I'm all for it, but some... Good night, Mr. Gallagher.
Night, Professor.
Okay, our movie this time is Teacher's Pet from 1958, and joining me to discuss this film is Movie Rob from the Movie Rob Minute. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Wow, it's been a long time, Todd, but I'm so glad to finally be back. I've just forgotten all about you.
Well, I guess appropriate given the name of this show. No, it's impossible to have forgotten, because I know we've actually done several episodes of your show and other podcasts we've been on together.
Yes.
So even though you haven't been on this show for a while, we have podcasted together. So why don't you, for the folks that were not with us the last time you were on the show, tell us all about who you are and what you do.
Okay, so I actually have two things going on. I have, first of all, my movie review website, movierob.wordpress.com, where you can go there and you can see over 10,000 movie reviews of movies that I've seen over the last, I think it's about 10 years. I think I started in April 2013. So, yeah, it's actually been a little over 10 years that I've been doing that. You can go there, see reviews of movies that I've seen, reviews of movies that I've seen again. I have some movies that I've reviewed 14, 15 times over the course of that period of time. And I also have my podcast that is a daily podcast. It's a Movies by Minute podcast, which I am currently in the fifth season. First season, I did The Great Escape. Second season, I did Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Third season, Die Hard. Fourth season, When Harry Met Sally. And right now, we're currently in the middle of the fifth season, Die Hard 2. Todd has been gracious and been a guest on my show for every one of those five seasons so far. So thank you, Todd, for that. As you mentioned, you and I have podcasted before on other shows that are not my show or your show. Some of those have aired. Some of those will probably never air. I had a lot of fun doing the Standby Minute with you, but I know that those five episodes are lost. Maybe in like 10 years we can do a forgotten film, you know, review of those episodes that we recorded that will never see the light of day.
Someday in some future universe, whatever technology they're using, then they'll release Stand By Me in that media form. They will somehow come across our recordings from that Minute By Minute podcast, and they'll include them as a bonus feature. I am confident of that.
Yeah. That's true. That's pretty much where I am. I'm hopefully in I think November going to be beginning my sixth season, which I haven't announced yet what it's going to be. So you just have to wait around and listen to Die Hard 2 until you figure out what the next season is.
Well, you know, I mean, it was no great chore being on those other seasons with you, because all those choices you've had of movies so far have been pretty irresistible. You know, they're all movies that I welcome the chance to talk about. I was actually struggling to remember going into this. I was going, how many seasons have there been so far? And so, yeah, you answered that right off the bat. And I know we're going to be recording.
Well, you've only been on four of them so far, since we haven't sat down to record the episodes for the fifth season yet. And because your episodes will only air in, I think, the end of August, or maybe even a little bit later than that.
Yes, yes. I'm looking forward to revisiting Die Hard 2, because it's been actually a long time since I've seen that one. I've found that, you know, when it comes to certainly the first three Die Hards, 2 is the one I've watched the least.
Ooh, that's not good. That's not good.
Oh, yeah. Well, and especially since I know it's, you know, whenever I am going and looking at things about movies, how they were made, where they were made and stuff, and I'm often curious about movies that were made in the region where I live, which is Denver, Colorado.
Yes,
and
that is correct.
Portions of Die Hard 2 were filmed at our old airport, Stapleton Airport, which hasn't existed now for 30 years almost. Denver International Airport opened right about the time I moved here. But yeah, they used Stapleton Airport in Denver to play the part of Dulles Airport in Die Hard 2. So I always struggle to call Die Hard 2 a Colorado movie, because it was filmed in Colorado, but it doesn't take place in Colorado. So it's
And there was no snow in Colorado when they were filming there. And there was no snow in any other place. They filmed in Washington. They filmed in Denver. They filmed in Seattle. They filmed in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and they had so many problems that there was no real snow throughout that entire movie. But, you know, we're getting off track here, because, you know, people are going to have to listen in at the end of August to hear us talk about it there on my site. So
yes, yes.
So everyone go there right now. When you finish listening to this episode.
No. When you're done with this show, yes. No, absolutely. So now, when it comes to these Movies by the Minute podcasts, I admit, you know, I admire what you're doing there, because I think, you know, it's a challenge enough for me to release episodes of my show I've been shooting for every week this year, and doing pretty good so far. And so, like, weekly is a challenge, but having an episode a day, I'm just like blown away. And I know you put a lot of work into the research and all that. There's a lot of, you know, trivia things that you dig up on these movies that I'm like, wow, I didn't, you know, I did some digging and I couldn't find that. You know, sometimes I wonder where on earth you're finding all these facts, but I'm thoroughly impressed.
It's a secret, trade secret.
Is it still fun to research all that stuff, or does it get a little bit like, oh, I got to dig through IMDb again and all this stuff?
No, it's so much fun, because, again, it's a different movie each time. And as anyone can tell by the five different movies that I've done, they're all very, very diverse. You know, we're not talking about you doing the same thing. That's also one of the reasons why I decided not to do the Die Hard movies back to back. Because I said, you know, I'll give myself something fresher in between, you know, so that I don't get a little too, what's the right word for it? You know, that I won't get into a rut. And just say, oh, this is what I'm doing again. You know, it's like every single time. It's something else. Think about it. I did a World War II movie at the beginning. Then I did a comedy. Then I did, you know, Die Hard. Then I did another comedy, but this time it's a romantic comedy. And then now I'm doing, you know, Die Hard 2. So, you know, it keeps things very fresh in my mind when I'm doing it, because the movies are a little different. And what I have in mind to do for season 6 is a classic. It's a black and white classic. So, you know, again, it's just changing things around, and so I'm not doing things by rote. Each time it's just very, very different. And you know, I do have some of the same guests each you know, on each season, but that's because, you know, I fortunately have a lot of friends out there, you know, who like podcasting about movies and are also willing to talk about all these, as you coined it before, these irresistible movies. So
yeah, yeah,
you know, it's just a lot of fun.
It is. And I mean, I kind of follow the same philosophy with things. I mean, I've met a lot of people, yourself included, through various channels, blogging, podcasting, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you meet these folks and it's great to have a chance to get to chat with them every once in a while about a movie that we love or a movie that we're discovering for the first time or whatever. It's all just, you know, it's that shared experience of the movies that we all enjoy. And we're able to do it even when we're on other sides of the globe from each other. So I think
that's correct.
That's wonderful. Yeah. So.
Yeah. And the great thing about it also is I'm assuming that you're similar to your situation is similar to mine that, you know, at home, you have less people to talk to that really enjoy movies as much as we do. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's a break to be able to talk to somebody who understands us.
Yeah.
You know, instead of saying, oh, you're going to talk about a movie again, you're going to sit for 3 hours recording 5 episodes to talk about a movie again. You know, I get that every week from my wife. And, you know, I give her a lot of credit because she lets me do it. You know, and notice I said lets me do it. but she knows how much I enjoy it. But she still feels, you know, afterwards she's like, you finished already? You talked enough? And I'm like, no, but you know, that was the time allotted to me. You know.
It's the same thing for me here. I mean, even just now, you know, coming down here to my basement to record this, I mean, I'll just share with everybody here. There's quite a time difference between myself and Rob.
Nine hours. I live in the future. I live in the future.
The rest of my family is heading off to bed right now. And I was like, I'm going downtown to podcast. My wife was like, what? And I said, I told you about this morning. I got our podcast late tonight. So, yeah, the things we do for our love of movies.
That is correct.
Well, let's get on with this movie we have here today. This is from 1958. It's called Teacher's Pet. And this is directed by a gentleman named George Seton. He is a director who has a lot of credits, and he played various roles through the course of his career. He started as an actor, first in radio. As a matter of fact, one of the facts I found about him, you know, this here, I'll be proud for a second. This is a Rob-style trivia type of thing here that I found. But
ooh, this is great. This is great.
According to his Wikipedia page, he played the Lone Ranger on early test broadcasts of that show. He, you know, he didn't go on to play that character on the actual show, but he claimed that through that, you know, those early test broadcasts that he created the Hi-Yo Silver line because he could not whistle for the horse, which is what the script indicated. I don't know if we can believe that or not, but eventually he moved on from acting. He would turn to writing and eventually directing films. Directed a lot of movies, though most of them are not considered the big name classics. There's two that really jumped out at me in his filmography. One, of course, is the original Miracle on 34th Street. And then the other one is 1970s Airport, which I have made it clear on this show and many others, I am a big fan of that movie and the whole Airport franchise. I think that series is crazy fun. Now, this film, though, it was written by the husband and wife writing team of Michael and Faye Kanin. They actually received an Academy Award nomination for the writing of this film. Now, this film, it centers on a guy named James Gannon, played by Clark Gable. He is the city editor for a major metropolitan newspaper. It's got a big bustling newsroom, and he's there making quick decisions to get the paper out every day. He's a self-made man. You know, he didn't graduate high school. He didn't graduate college. He just learned the newspaper business by actually doing it, you know, working his way up, probably starting as like a copy boy and working his way up the ranks. And he is very proud of that fact. Okay. So he doesn't then respond positively, of course, when he is invited to do a guest lecture for a local college journalism class. He does not think that the classroom is the way to go when it comes to learning about journalism. He even goes so far as to write a rather nasty, self-righteous letter to the instructor who invited him, rather than just saying, no thanks. I'm not interested. So he has no intention to going to this class and doing the lecture, but his boss calls him in and tells him, you have to go do this because the college instructor is an old friend of, I don't remember if it was the paper's owner or somebody on the board, something like that. But, you know, basically he's told, you've got no choice. You've got to go do this. So Gannon goes to the class and he is surprised to find that the instructor is one Erica Stone, played by Doris Day, an attractive young teacher with a nice pair of legs, which he seems to notice as she walks in for the first time.
It's actually very funny. It's very funny when he's trying to find out who she is and he walks over to all these older women.
Yes. Yes, he kind of picks out this lady that looks kind of older and more like the school marm type, and he assumes that she's the instructor, but she's not. So anyway, he kind of settles into a seat, but he doesn't, you know, let his presence be known to this attractive young teacher. And before he has a chance to introduce himself so he can give the lecture, Miss Stone produces the letter that he wrote and reads it to the whole class. So this upsets him, and he then resolves that he's going to continue through the class posing as a student, basically so he can show the teacher up and prove that you can't learn journalism in the classroom. Now, at first, Miss Stone finds him a bit annoying, but when he starts to write articles for the class projects and stuff, she is quite impressed with his writing, and she starts to see him as a bit of a star pupil. Meanwhile, Gannon is becoming quite infatuated with his teacher and starts to kind of make the moves on her. He eventually finds that he has to contend with another professor who seems to have his eye on Miss Stone as well, a psychology professor named Dr. Hugo Pine, played by Gig Young. And then, of course, there's just the little problem that this budding romance is all based on a lie. So will the truth come out? Will the couple stay together? It's standard kind of rom-com type of stuff that we've seen for ages, though this is much earlier in the game, and you could probably say influenced a lot of rom-coms that we know and love. But I'm going to let Rob start us out here. Give us a few of your thoughts on Teacher's Pet.
All right. Well, I chose this movie because it's something it's a movie that I came across by accident years ago. You know, I think I had gotten like TMC or TCM, you know, on cable like 20 something years ago. And I was just watching all these old movies and I just came across one that's a Teacher's Pet. And, you know, the first time I actually saw it was on the 18th of August, 2001. So yeah, it's been 22 years since I first saw this movie. And I immediately fell in love with it. I thought it was such a fun movie. I mean, yes, the biggest criticism that anyone has about this movie is the very large age gap between Clark Gable and Doris Day. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a 21 year difference between the two of them. So, yeah, it's very noticeable. But you know, if you just put that to the side, it's less of an issue. You know, I think that first of all, I think Doris Day is really beautiful in this movie. I think she, you know, she fits the part really well. She might be a little young to be a professor, but we do find out through the course of the movie that her father owned a small town paper that was read around the world. So she basically grew up, you know, in the newsroom, you know, which is pretty ironic because of the whole idea that, you know, the big debate of this movie is, you know, what's better, experience in the newsroom or learning about it through, you know, through education and then using your education to then go and write your stories and stuff like that. So, you know, it's just a really, really fun movie. The, you know, they hit all of the screwball comedy / rom-com tropes that one can even think of with this type of movie. And they use innuendo a little too well here also. You know, back at the time during the Hays Code when there were things that they actually couldn't say or do. But, you know, they allude to so many things also. And you slowly see how, you know, he's infatuated with her, but she slowly starts to actually enjoy the attention that he's giving her and realizing that there might be something more to it than her just thinking that he's this star pupil.
I think she's enjoying the attention, but also I would say I think she also enjoys kind of the idea that she's teaching him something, that he's
right.
Somehow growing, you know, out of his, his box, which she thinks he's a wallpaper salesman, you know, and that he's, you know, experiencing new horizons and that. So, I mean, there are certainly charming aspects of the film. I think I'm a little more mixed on it. I certainly enjoyed it. And I think there's a lot of things that are about it that are certainly interesting in the context of just the legacy of rom-coms that we see going forward.
Have you seen this before, or you only saw this the first time seeing it?
Yeah, this was a first time watch for me. One of the things that was really interesting about watching this is because just a few weeks ago, within the last 12 or so episodes, I don't remember, this year is flying by, but recently we did an episode of this show on another movie that had Clark Gable, and that was Night Nurse, a pre-code movie from 1932, I think it was, or maybe 31, but anyway, and he plays the bad guy in that, and you know, he's this just, you know, handsome and you know, but also really violent and nasty character in that. And so, you know, it's interesting now to see him many, many years later here, you know, an aging version of Clark Gable and still, you know, being the romantic leading man in certain ways. Though, I mean, he's still not kind of the typical romantic lead here, because, I mean, he is a very kind of abrasive and gruff character in this.
Yeah, because his character acts as if he knows everything. That's part of, I guess, the charm of him, that, you know, because it adds to the debate as to what's more important. I mean, he got to where he got in the newsroom based on his experience in the newsroom. You know, as you said, he probably started off as just an errand boy and worked his way up. And at a certain point, you know, he's now the city editor. So it's not something that one gets to that easily without a lot of hard work and without knowing what it is that you're doing. That, I mean, for me, it was also very interesting watching this movie, thinking about how, print copy has changed so much over the last 65 years since this movie came out. Mm. You know, nowadays, you know, even thinking about a newsroom and reporters and editors and stuff like that, it's all done so differently nowadays. Back then, that was where you got your news. I mean, they mentioned something in the movie. There was a line that someone said that you got to get the information out as quickly as possible, because by the following morning, you know, no one's going to care anymore because they're already on to the next bit of information. And in the world that we live in today, that lasts, you know, an hour. It doesn't even last a day.
Well, not even that. Yeah. I mean, it's got to be instant.
I was being generous with the hour, but yeah.
No, well, I agree. I think one of the most intriguing aspects of this film is that look at the news industry. And I think for me, that was the most enjoyable aspect of the movie. The romance side of things is pleasant enough. There is that hurdle about the age difference, which we'll talk about more here, I'm sure. But I thought the angle of kind of a look at the news industry and kind of the different schools of thought at this time in history was the most intriguing aspect of the film. And I really appreciated, too, that this is a movie that I don't think was too glowing in its look at reporters. One of the things that I get frustrated with a bit when it comes to movies about reporters is I think that too often they just have this very idealistic view of the profession, where, you know, they're kind of presented as they're these champions of the truth and you know, fighting the good fight and all that stuff. And I
like
think
Fletch, right?
Well, Fletch is maybe a little different, but but you know, I'm thinking like
All the President's Men.
Yes, exactly. No. You know,
I knew exactly where you were going. I thought I'd throw in Fletch there because, you know, you and I are both kids of the 80s, so that's just the epitome of an 80s reporter. Irwin M. Fletcher. You know.
But you know, those movies, while I think both the examples you cited there are excellent films, in some ways the reporters are presented as being these almost otherworldly figures who just are the champions of right and all that. I'm like, I think that the waters are a bit more muddied in the real world. I'm someone
have you, have
that.
Have you ever seen Shattered Glass?
I have not.
Have you ever heard of it?
I don't think so.
Okay, so Shattered Glass is based on a true story, and it came out in 2003 with Hayden. It's with Hayden Christensen. It's one of those movies that shows that he does, that he is a great actor, you know, as opposed to just thinking of him as, you know, speaking George Lucas dialogue for two movies, right? So this is, it's a story, it's based on a reporter from the New Republic who was suspected of fabricating most of his stories, okay? And the movie has also Peter Sarsgaard in it, Chloe Sevigny, Rosario Dawson, Hank Azaria, Steve Zahn. I mean, it's just a great movie that shows a completely different side of reporting. So, you know, you mentioned that. And so anyone, and yourself included, should this isn't my recommendation yet.
Yeah, no.
But it's a side recommendation. But it shows, you know, how you're talking about the fact how reporters think that they sometimes, in movies at least, think that they are the champions of right. And here's an example of someone who was trying to be the champion of right, but then the question arises, is all this he's reporting, is it true or not?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, and with this movie that we're talking about here, I think, you know, there's some interesting moments where you see Doris Day's character kind of talking about ways that she thinks that the industry has gone astray a bit. You know, I'm trying to remember what she talks about, but blood and sex or something like that, I think is what she says. And
then,
you know,
yeah, he has a great line there. His response, he goes, well, there's a lot of blood in this. She asked him to check about a murder. So he goes, well, there's a lot of blood dealing with this murder. And he goes, and what do you think about sex?
Yeah. And she says, well, I'm for it. You know, which,
exactly.
Yeah.
Here, no, here's the exact quote. He goes, look at this. She says, look at this. Blood and sex. Journalism is so much more than blood and sex. You liked my story about the murder. That's blood, isn't it? Wait a minute. I didn't say I disapprove of blood. It's just that, how do you feel about sex? Well, I'm all for it. But.
Yeah. And I mean, that exchange, I think, is a great example of where another area where I think this film really succeeds. I think the script is one of the better aspects. And again, there was an Academy Award nomination that came out of the script there. And I get it. It's one of those kind of punchy, fun scripts that's fast paced with the dialogue. You know, it hits you with a funny line kind of out of the blue here and there. And, you know, I liked the way the script moved. I liked the dialogue better than I think I liked the story itself. You know, let's put it that way.
Okay. All right. I can hear that. I mean, I don't 100% agree with you on that, but I definitely can hear what you're saying about that. You know, I also like the fact that they bring in the Gig Young character, you know, and we think at the beginning he's one thing, and then we find out he's something else completely, you know, throughout the course of the movie. So I think that really works.
I agree. I think the Gig Young character is another one of the best aspects. And again, this is where there was some award consideration. I think he got an Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he may be the MVP when it comes to the performances, just because there's just this wonderful, I don't know, there's a smarminess about him. There's something that's a little bit off kilter where he, you know, he's this guy that's, you know, very smart, knows a lot from books. He's been around the world. He knows all this stuff, but his people skills aren't necessarily the best. And, you know, just is this character who maybe, you know, he spent more time in the classroom than in the real world, but there's still something that's kind of playful and fun about the character.
Yeah, and I like the fact that they use him as a confidant to both sides.
Well, and that's a real surprise, I think, because you really think they're setting this guy up primarily to be a romantic rival, that he's going to be making the moves on Doris Day's character, and, you know, that there's going to be just this butting of heads between him and Clark Gable. And there is initially, and, you know, again, that leads to a very fun sequence where Clark Gable's trying to get him drunk so that he kind of, I guess, embarrasses himself in front of her and all that.
Which has a great ending with when the two of them are talking, and, you know, he said, well, don't feel so bad about getting drunk last night. I paid the waiter $5 to spike your drink. And he goes, oh, I guess I got a lot to learn. I only paid him $2 to spike yours.
Yeah. And he does a great job of playing hungover. I tell you, I love the sequence where he was waking up the next morning and
with the bells. Tell,
yes, the thing with the bells on the doorbell is great. Plus, partially that scene just brought back memories for me because I think one of my grandparents had a doorbell like that where it had the box hanging up there close to the ceiling and these huge tubular bells hanging down from it. And the way he kind of stumbles with those bells trying to shut them up because the doorbell's just ringing too loud in his head. It's a great comedic moment. But I like the way then that scene, like you say, progresses because right away, the rivalry between him and Clark Gable starts to dissolve there. And, you know, you really feel like this is a guy he could kind of go either way in this situation. You know, if he ends up winning Doris Day, great. If not, hey, I'm going to make Clark Gable my buddy, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Because they do have what to talk about throughout the whole thing. I love when I think one of the interesting things about this movie is that it, you know, in the 50s, that was a time when people were starting to understand that, you know, education and university is something that's a little more important than people thought beforehand, even if you're not going to go into a trade. And this movie tries to show on the one hand, that there's a large gap between trade work and work that you do after you get a degree. And mm-hmm. on the other hand, to show that there isn't much of a gap, you know, because they show... He orders all the books that Dr. Hugo Pine wrote, and he gets all these really thick psychology books that have to go through and stuff like that. And the reaction that he gets from Gig Young later on about those books, he goes, I've never read any of my books. I just write them. You know, so I think that's part of what they were trying to show here.
Well, and, you know, the way they kind of show, I guess, also the differences just in the environments that, you know, our two main characters are in, where you have Clark Gable in the bustling newsroom, and then, you know, Doris Day in the classroom, and her history, you know, with her father and all that stuff. Two different worlds, so to speak, but that ultimately are, you know, both have the same goals in mind and such.
Correct. It's just different ways of getting there. You know.
Yeah. And yeah, I got to mention, too, you're talking about that scene with all the books and stuff. That was a fun moment. I loved those moments in the newsroom showing all the different colorful characters that are in there. And, you know, they bring in those books and all the other staff, you know, are all kind of gathering around and they're all, you know, oohing and aahing over the different books. And, you know, Clark Gable's trying to tell himself and tell them that, oh, you know, this is just some stuffy academic type and painting the picture of him being like this old man type of thing. And then one of the ladies goes, oh, look at this picture here on the book. And they're all like, oh, he's hot. You know, that stuff. Fun sequence.
Yeah. And also the whole idea that, you know, he has to pay like $83 for all the books.
Yeah.
You know, back and think about that $83 in 1958. How much do you think, did you check to see how much you think that would be worth today?
Oh man, I'm telling you. Well, it just the wildness of the idea that he can, you know, have someone call an order down to the bookstore and the bookstore is going to come deliver it to him, you know.
Right. I did a rough estimate. So $83 in 1958 is worth $871 today. So think about that. If you were to order out books and you have to pay almost $900 for those books, you'd be like, I can't believe that I've spent so much money on that. You'd think they would have given, it would have told him an estimate beforehand, as opposed to just saying, okay, this is what it's going to cost you.
Well, let's talk a bit more about our lead performances here. I mean, we mentioned Gig Young as being a favorite and that he got an Oscar nomination, but we kind of skipped over Gable and Doris Day here. I guess let's start with Clark Gable. I mean, what do you think of his performance here?
Again, I like it. The one drawback is the age difference here. He feels, I mean, he was 57 when he made this movie.
That's, yeah, I think that's right.
A little, and I mean, he died a year and a half later at the age of 50. I think he died at 58, so maybe he was 56 at the time or something like that. You know, I'm sorry, he was 59 when he died. He died in November of 1960. So when this movie came out, I guess it was 2 years before, he was 57. But his character, he plays his character with a great presence, you know, despite the age difference, you know, because we see how much he's, I guess, shy. You know, he can act like a little schoolboy, I guess you can say.
Yeah, he kind of turns into a different character when he's, in the classroom. He's very much, like we said, this kind of hardened, grizzled newsman type of thing in reality. But when he's in the classroom, he kind of becomes this, like, wide-eyed, gee willikers type of a character.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I one of the things, one of the big trivia bits of this movie that I love is the fact that they before they even offered the part to Gable, they offered it to Cary Grant and James Stewart, who are both respectively three and 7 years younger than Gable. And they both turned it down because they said that this character needs to be younger. And then they ended up giving the part to someone who was even older than the two of them.
Actually, I don't know if it's so much that the character needed to be younger, but I do think definitely, given that the leading lady is Doris Day, and like you said, there's a 21-year gap there. I mean, it really shows. I mean, I was thinking about it
and
as I was watching.
They filmed
this.
It in black and white. This movie was filmed in black and white in order to try to make it seem as if their ages are closer. You know, that doesn't work as well.
And, you know, as I was watching it, I was thinking, well, I mean, there's certainly plenty of other examples out there of movies where you have an older man and a much younger woman, especially in this era.
That's right.
Just recently, I was watching Sabrina, which is a prime example of that, you know, where you've got Humphrey Bogart and Audrey Hepburn.
And Harrison Ford and Greg Kinnear, you know, it's the same thing.
With Sabrina, I was, I don't know, I, even though I was kind of like, all right, I don't like this age difference, it feels weird, but I think I was able to move past it somehow quicker than I was with this movie.
Really interesting. I look at it the other way. In Sabrina, in both versions of Sabrina, it distracted me more than it did here.
Yeah, I don't know. For this one, I think it really distracted me more. I there's a part of me that thought I would like to see it if, I mean, don't get me wrong, I like Doris Day in this movie. I think she gives a great performance. But I think it would have been interesting if she had been an older woman and you'd had a rom-com that was about 250-something people here.
Right. I think it might have worked even better.
Yeah.
You know, if they found the right person to have the right chemistry with Clark Gable. I mean, come on, you have the scenes with Mamie Van Doren, you know, who's 30 years younger than Clark Gable, and he's, you know, hanging out with her in the club and stuff like that. You know, so I guess he is going for the older woman by going after Doris Day.
I guess you could put it that way. Yeah,
because Doris Day is 9 years older than Mamie Van Doren. So
I want to get back to Mamie Van Doren in a second here. But with Doris Day, I mean, your thoughts on her performance?
Again, I think it's fun. I really have always enjoyed Doris Day movies where she gets like a little song to sing in the middle, mm-hmm. you know, where she sings here quite well. The theme song of the movie, Teacher's Pet, is great. But, you know, when she sings the tea song, it's just really, really funny because she's basically making fun of Jim Gannon or Clark Gable, however you want to look, you know, however you want to describe that particular, you know, the character / actor. She's making fun of him by singing that song, but she just does such a great job. And, you know, she wins me over when she does that because she had a great voice. No question about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I admit, I haven't seen all of Doris Day's stuff. I've seen, you know, several of her films. I've actually got a box set of several of her films up in my box of DVDs that I haven't gotten to yet. So I've got,
I've got several more to get to. But, I mean, there's just something always very, very charming about her. It's one of those cases where you watch her in a movie and you go, okay, I get why she was America's sweetheart, you know?
Yeah.
There's no denying that there. So, yeah, I think she does a fine job in this movie. You know, I think there is a fair degree of chemistry between her and Clark Gable. But, yeah, I really stumbled on the age difference. I keep going back to that, I know. But, oh, well.
That's fair. I can understand that.
I do want to jump back to some other supporting players here. You mentioned Mamie Van Doren, and I loved seeing her pop up in this movie. You know, her appearance is pretty short, but she's basically playing like she's this lounge singer. And, you know, I don't want to call her Clark Gable's girlfriend because I don't get the impression that there's that much to the relationship. It's kind of like, he calls her up every now and then to hang on his arm when he goes out for the night, you know, type of thing. And, you know, it doesn't strike me that there's really that much to their relationship.
You don't think that she's like a one-night stand for him type of thing? You know, like,
well, I think that's certainly a possibility, but she certainly doesn't seem too jealous when she can see, you know, that he's got his eye on Doris Day on the other side of the room there.
Right. Right, but maybe that's because she, you know, she's just looking at him as someone that she can have a good physical time with, you know, she can find someone else to be with her also.
Yeah, you know, no, yeah, you're probably right. But, you know, maybe Van Doren, a lot of times I think people think of her as being like a low-budget Marilyn Monroe, but every time I've seen her in movies, she just has a great screen presence, and she was a really good actress, and I think shines in a way that some of the other blonde bombshells don't. And she's still with us. She's 92 years old.
I was actually shocked. Yeah, I was shocked that she's still around. 92.
But I love the little scene that she has there with Clark Gable. It's another example where I think, you know, the script really has some nice moments. She has some nice interactions with him. You know, and it's weird because he's just totally not interested in her in this moment. And you're going, man, that's maybe Van Doren who's hanging on you right now. But then a few minutes later, she has a musical number because she's a singer in this lounge, this bar, wherever it is that they are. And it's just a showstopper. That musical moment, I was not expecting it. And I was just like, whoa, that's really, really nuts. Especially the cutaway shots to Clark Gable and Doris Day's reactions to her overtly sexual movements through this musical number. Just the discomfort on Clark Gable's face is amazing.
Right. That's true. Because it's great because we see that he, you know, wants to try and impress, you know, Erica Stone the whole time. And then when he realizes the overtness of this song, so then we see that he's not as comfortable there as he was, as he normally would be. Let's put it that way. You know, he's embarrassed to be there with her.
And Doris Day is reacting to him. She can tell he's uncomfortable and she's just eating it up.
Well, again, I mentioned before about the fact that she makes fun of him by singing that same exact song a little later on. You know, so she picked up on it. She definitely picked up on the whole idea that you know, this is going to make Clark Gable's character feel a little bit uncomfortable.
I also wanted to throw out one other member of the cast who caught me completely off guard because I wasn't expecting her to be in there.
I know who you're gonna say.
Yeah, but Marion Ross, Mrs. C from Happy Days, up in this movie as Doris Day's secretary, and I did not recognize her at first, but when she spoke, I was like, oh my, I know that voice. And it took probably all of about 30 seconds for me to realize that was Mrs. C. It's always wild when you see these people that you grew up watching on TV every week many years earlier. I mean, this is, I think, about 15, 16 years before Happy Days started. And it was just wild because, you know, you so associate people with certain characters that they played for a long, long time. And, yeah, I was not expecting her. And, you know, she's got a small part, but it's fun.
Yeah, I mean, I used to, well, what I do is when I watch older movies, mostly stuff from, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, I spend the time to actually pay attention, you know, when they have the credits at the beginning of who all the actors are, because I always look for names of people that I would recognize, you know, that are there in relatively smaller parts. So this time when I rewatched it, I can't remember if I noticed her in the past, but this time I saw that it said Marion Ross, and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I wonder who she's going to play. So I was on the lookout for her this time. Mm-hmm. You know, and when I came across her, I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And as you said, you know, I heard the voice and, you know, I was able to make that connection quite easily. She was on 255 episodes of Happy Days. Wow.
That show ran for a long, long time.
For 10 years. It ran from 74 to 84.
Hey, I watched that like every Tuesday night when I was a kid. You watched Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, Three's Company. That was the order, you know.
So. Right. And then Fantasy Island, Love Boat, you know, all that stuff.
There's some other recognizable faces that show up in this thing, too. I mean, Nick Adams is in here playing kind of the young kid who, you know, is kind of, you know, on a similar trajectory, or, you know, wanting to follow the career path that Clark Gable's character did. And, of course, his mother is all against that. I don't know how I felt about that whole framing device of the movie. You know, the whole, it starts with this mother confronting Clark Gable because she wants her son to go back to school and all that. I don't know. I mean, it was almost like driving the point home a little bit too much about the whole real world experience versus college.
But I think what they were trying to do there is to show the, you know, the reality of it. That here we are in the late 1950s, and a mother is very concerned that she wants her son to get an education. And since the movie has such a debate about education versus experience, so this is just to show us, okay, here's, you know, we have that character, and then we had the other character also who we know is a college graduate, and he says, oh, you know, Gannon says, just because he's a college graduate doesn't mean he's not going to start from the bottom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yeah. The way he treats him is not very good either. You know, until later on, he starts to appreciate him a little bit more by you know, what he has learned over the years. And it's not just because he knows that Erica Stone was a teacher. You know, so I like the way they did that also.
Well, we should probably start moving towards the break here. But before we do, let's just talk briefly about the ending, mainly in terms of kind of the whole, you know, the rom-com tropes type of thing. I mean, with a rom-com, you always know the relationship's going to have its ups and its downs. You know, they're going to be together, they're going to break up, the lies are going to be discovered, all that kind of stuff. But then, you know, things get tied up with a nice little bow and it's a happy ending. I guess the question is, do things get wrapped up a bit too nicely with this one? Because, I don't know, there's a part of me that thought, you forgave him too quickly.
Well, you got to take into consideration that Hugo Pine was actually trying to help Gannon, you know, by buttering Erica with the whole idea. Once she found out, you know, the fact that he was going to come clean beforehand, mm-hmm. So that might have had some effect on it also.
Yeah.
Plus,
yeah,
the movie was right. Coming in at 2 hours anyway, so they needed to get that done.
they had to wrap it up. Yeah, they did wrap it up very quickly there. Yeah. All right. Well, before we take it to the break, any final thoughts you have on this one?
No, it's just a fun movie. And I think anyone who likes romantic comedies, if you like Clark Gable, Doris Day, or if you like the journalism profession and are interested in seeing, you know, this debate between education and experience, then I think you should check this movie out.
Yeah. I mean, I agree that it was a fun movie. I think I found the journalism stuff to be more interesting than the romance stuff, but I still thought it was an enjoyable film for sure. All right, well, let's take a quick break here. We'll hear from another Lamb Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Film Cast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
In a world where podcasts already seem to address every imaginable subject, one man broke new ground with a seemingly random obsession about exploding helicopters in movies. He was a podcaster on the edge, a maverick broadcaster who played by his own rules. Now, he has a last chance to talk about the strange way helicopters explode in film. Exploding Helicopter. Available on iTunes and Podomatic now. Think you know about chopper fireballs?
think again.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just wanted to remind you that you can now help support this show through Patreon. For just a few dollars a month, you can support this show and earn access to some great bonus features. Please visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat. The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
All right, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where myself and my guest each get to talk about another movie, something that we've enjoyed that we want to tell others about. It might be a forgotten film, might be an old classic, could be something new in theaters, new on streaming. It can be absolutely anything. So, Rob, what is your recommendation?
I actually want to recommend the movie Music Box from 1989.
Oh, I know this one. I haven't seen it, but Jessica Lange, right?
That's right. Jessica Lange. First of all, it has a great cast. Not besides Jessica Lange, you have Jessica Lange, Armin Mueller-Stahl, Frederick Forrest, Donald Moffat, Lucas Haas, and you even get Michael Rooker in there. You know, and so I'm not going to spoil this movie then because you've never seen it. And I'm assuming other people who are listening also haven't seen it. But the idea is it's about a woman who's a lawyer whose father is an immigrant from Hungary. And he is accused of being a collaborator with the Nazis from 40 years earlier. And they want to revoke his citizenship because they claim that he lied on his U.S. citizenship because they claimed that he lied on his visa application, 30, 40 years earlier. And I mean, this is a movie that was written by Joe Esterhaz, and it was directed by Costa Gavras. And it's a great movie because it doesn't let us really know until the end what's going on, because it keeps things very, very ambiguous. And, you know, the story can go either way. Is he really a collaborator? Is he not? And you have to wait until the end to really find out what the truth is throughout the whole movie. And it's very gripping throughout the whole, the way that the whole movie moves along. Because it brings up the issues of, you know, what do we really know about our parents? You know, do we believe what they tell us or do we not believe what they tell us? Do we believe what other people say about our parents or do we believe not? That's the type of issues that this movie brings up, and it's just done really, really well. And yeah, that's my recommendation, Music Box.
I remembered that this had a Best Actress nomination for Jessica Lange, but yeah, this is one I just never got to back in the day. I mean, granted, back in the late 80s, I mean, I wasn't really seeking out this type of a story, you know. 89, I was going to Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade and Ghostbusters 2 and stuff like that. And yeah, Music Box just came and went, and I never got around to it. So I will definitely have to get around to that one. It's funny, when I was looking it up here as you were talking about it, and you mentioned it was written by Joe Esterhaus, and I actually, this is not my recommendation, but I actually randomly watched a movie that I did not realize was written by Joe Esterhaus earlier this week, and it was another one from the 80s that I had never gotten around to called Big Shots, and it's about a suburban kid who ends up going into the city of Chicago, and he meets up with a young African-American boy, and they develop an interesting friendship, and the suburban kid kind of starts to become street smart and all that stuff. And I had heard about the film for ages and never got around to watching it. Watched it this week, and it said written by Joe Esterhaus. I was like, really? Basic Instinct, Joe Esterhaus?
Did you like it? Did you like Big Shots? Because I saw it for the first time a few months ago, and I wasn't the biggest fan of it. I didn't hate it, but it wasn't that, you know, it didn't work as well for me as I thought it would, as I would hope that it would.
Yeah, I was also kind of lukewarm on it. I thought it had some interesting things going on, but I didn't think the execution was fantastic. So yeah,
That's not my recommendation.
Right. Just one bit of trivia about Music Box, which is great. A few years after this movie came out, Esterhaz actually found out that his father was a Nazi collaborator and stopped talking to his father.
Oh, that's wild. You know?
And again, if they would have said it, that it happened beforehand and that thought it gave him the idea of writing this script and stuff like that, I would say, oh, that would be great. But this is like something that happened afterwards, which is just wow. And they said that he didn't talk to his father ever again, after he died. No, obviously he didn't talk to him after he died. He didn't talk to him after he died.
Yeah.
No. He didn't speak to his father again for the rest of his father's life. There you go.
All right. Well, the movie that I'm going to recommend, actually, I'm going to recommend something that's brand new from this year.
Are we allowed?
We are allowed. We can recommend anything. I mean, it's my show. I can do what I want. But, I got to the movie theater a couple of times in the last week. But this is actually not a movie that I saw in the movie theater. This is something that just hit a couple of the streaming services here in the U.S. Since this is a Fox Searchlight film, it is on Hulu and Disney Plus. And this is the film Flamin' Hot, which is directed by Eva Longoria. I was just intrigued by this concept when I first heard about it. Plus, it seems like there's been a couple of films this year already. I mean, the year's not even halfway done. And already we've had several movies this year that are about kind of the creation of products that we all know and love. Okay. Yeah. So like you had Air, which was about the Air Jordans. You had Tetris, you had BlackBerry. And so now you have Flamin' Hot, which is about the guy who came up with Flamin' Hot Cheetos. This is the true story of a guy named Richard Montanez. He's a Mexican American working as a janitor at a Frito-Lay factory. And he's struggling to support his family. And with layoffs looming at his factory, he has this idea to bring the kind of spiciness that the Mexican-American community that he's a part of love in their food to snack food. And he and his family start experimenting with these different mixtures of spices and peppers, et cetera, and eventually come up with what becomes Flamin' Hot Cheetos. And this is just a really fun, feel-good kind of movie. It just hit me in all the right spots. The main character is played by Jesse Garcia, and it's just a really great performance. He plays this hardworking guy who you just want to see him succeed. And the film has some great themes around things like family, community, faith, creativity, ingenuity. I mean, classic feel-good sort of stuff. And involve his family in the creation of this. You know, he gets involved with his community, trying to get the word out, make it a success and all that. And the film just has a lot of heart. It's funny in the right spots. It's touching in the right spots. And I just kind of randomly sat down with this one just this afternoon and just really enjoyed it. And it's a movie that the whole family can enjoy. So I haven't heard a whole lot of press about it, but I definitely recommend Flamin' Hot.
Wow. All right. Well, you convinced me to go check it out. So, anyone who wants to go check it, my assumption is that I will have a review on it on my site by the time this show drops. So.
Excellent. Well, Rob, I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find all your stuff.
All right. Well, if you're looking for my movie reviews, you can go to movierob.wordpress.com. And if you're looking for my podcast, then you can, just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, or you can go directly to my website, movierobminutes.com.
Excellent. Thanks again for being on the show. And I will be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast. Well, folks, that's going to do it for this episode of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening.
If you'd like to read some other reviews of Forgotten Films, you can find them over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. I'd love to hear your questions, comments, and feedback about the show, so feel free to email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And of course, don't forget to visit our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn more about how you can help support this show. Once again, thanks for listening. Until next time, watch some old movies. We'll see you real soon.
Morning. Hangover?
Calling what I have a hangover is like referring to the Johnstown flood as a slight drizzle.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.